This is Hitchhiking Off the Map.
And we went to the psychic, man, like freak shows and psychics. So there was a freak show. So we went to see the Lobster Lady.
I've never seen anything like that. And I watched it for an hour.
And I was just appalled by it all. But my aunt had this sort of morbid fascination with like freak shows.
That first trip? Let's see, what do I remember clearly about the first trip?
And I could just as easily have missed it.
I didn't have a choice about it. And I was only 5 years old. I had no choice.
Well, all I remember, Lobster Lady could comb the back of her hair with her foot. She put like a brush in her foot because she was so jointed in her legs. That was very vivid.
These vivid, precious memories of childhood. We bring them to you from our studio in Sebastopol, California, surrounded by the apple trees in blossom, feral cats, possums, raccoons, gophers, snails, and this is Conrad Bishop.
And Elizabeth Fuller, and Hitchhiking Off the Map, with stories about journeys.
And this is episode 52. We have been on the air for an entire year. I am absolutely amazed. Actually, more than a year, since on public radio we have preemptions for fundraising and wartime coverage, and there seems to be ample likelihood of continued fundraising and wars. Alien 3, Star Wars 4, Rocky 6, Son of Flubber. Well, even Shakespeare did it. Henry VI, Part 3. Sequels are a pretty good bet, but we're getting off the track. That's the hazard of journeys. The news, after all, is just another controlled substance.
Ooh. Well, we take journeys as a pretty broad metaphor. We don't provide travel tips or travelogues, I guess. Well, journey is really a way of looking at any human experience. Going into the unknown, maybe coming back, maybe migrating. But either way, something's different.
Or you can sit there in your chair and the world will do it for you. From time to time, we're going back to our archives and revisiting some of our favorite features from the past. It's always been true in our theatrical work that one comes back to the same story with different eyes.
Oh, yeah. Just think about Macbeth. The very first time that we did it, which was in 1972, and I was just barely newly pregnant for the first time and played Lady Macbeth. And then years later, in 77, we did a new production of Macbeth, but by that time we were parents. And it was astonishing, with having had two kids, how much we saw in it then that we had missed before, about children and the loss of children and the promise. You come back with different eyes.
So we bring you again, Fred Ponsloff.
Fred is an actor and a teacher and a screenwriter in Los Angeles and an old friend. This is one of our favorites.
This story goes from Wisconsin to New York to California, and from the tall, gawky, panicked college freshman we knew in Milwaukee to the rugged, joyous 50-year-old we caught up with in L.A. I asked, what were your earliest memories of trips alone?
I'm trying to think of when that was, because I was raised to be very independent when I was a kid. I mean, my aunt, God bless her, you know, would go way out on a limb to let me do things that no other, like, 5-year-old or 4-year-old or 6-year-old would do, you know. I remember we lived in sort of like the suburbs of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and she would send me downtown on a bus, and I bet you I was 6, 7. And she'd give me money for the bus. She'd send me downtown, which was like 15 miles away. And I would do this sort of department store shopping for her. And I could barely reach the counter, you know, to return things and stuff. I mean, it was this little body underneath the counter. And I would reach over and, you know, supply the money and exchange her nylon stockings for something else that she needed. I remember it was so bizarre. And people were just appalled that this little 6 and 7-year-old kid was growing up. But she raised me very independently. So I don't ever remember a time where I was, like, really frightened. So, I mean, I think when I moved, it was like a natural step. When I went to New York eventually to live, it was like a natural thing for me to do.
Well, I said, but Fred, when we heard you'd moved to New York, we said, Fred in New York? Driving a cab? Fred? You didn't seem to have an overwhelming instinct for survival.
What is he doing? My first night in New York, I had my friends were going to Turkey, and I was staying in their apartment. They said, Toby's going to take care of you. She's upstairs. If you have any questions, go on upstairs and she'll help you. And we've given you some outlines of what to do in New York, but just know that Toby's there for you. And I went, fine. So they leave that night. About 11 o'clock at night, I hear this little at the door. And I said, my first night in New York, who is it? And she said, this woman said, Toby, it's Toby from upstairs. And I thought, oh, great, I get to meet my first friend. I open the door. She has just cut her wrists. And she's standing there, bleeding, and saying, will you take me to the emergency room? Because I've changed my mind. And I am like, this is the person who's going to take care of me in New York. And that sort of was the beginning of my New York adventure. Dear Diary, this would never happen in Wisconsin. Cab driving stories are like amazing. My first cab driving story was when I realized I had been, you know, to be a cab driver in New York takes absolutely no brains. And in fact, if you get a cab driving license, they give you the answers to the test before you go down to the commission to take the test. So I didn't know New York at all when I was on my first couple of nights on the street. I had no clue where anything was. So I was driving 1 week and this guy got in the cab, three-piece suit, business suit, really, you know, together, businessman. And he said to me, I want to go to Chinatown. And I said, well, you know what? I don't know where Chinatown is. I've only been driving a week. But if you show me the way, I'll be glad to take you there. And he said, fine, just go down Broadway. So we're driving a little bit and he says, you know, that's a lie. And I said, what? He said that you've only been driving a week. They all say that. And I said, no, really. I've only been driving a week. I'm very sincere about that. He said, well, just keep on driving. He said, I bet you hate your parents too. And I was like, and now I'm in the front seat trying to figure out, I'm fresh from Wisconsin. You know, customer's always right. And I'm not going to create any. I went, no, I really, I don't hate my parents. I really don't. He said, oh, you do. You all do. And I was trying to figure out who you all was. You know, you all do. Then I drove a little more and he said, did you go to college? I said, yes, I did. He said, what kind of degree did you get? I said, a BFA. And he said, and you're driving cab. And I said, yeah, that's right. And he said, you know what? You're a flop. He said, you know, you didn't have the brains to be a doctor or a lawyer. He said, you're a flop driving a cab. Now I'm silent. I'm not even saying anything. Another couple blocks away, he said, I bet you're a faggot too. A faggot flop driving a cab. Now I have no clue where this guy is coming from, you know. And he's on a roll. I mean, he doesn't stop at this point. He's like, you faggot, you flop, you know, you hate your parents. Here you are driving a cab. You're never going to be anybody, you know. And I'm like in the front seat, you know, doing this slow burn. But I'm figuring, just get him to Chinatown. Get rid of him. You know, you don't want to create anything. It's your first week on the job, you know. So we get to Chinatown, and the fare is $3.50. And I said, sir, that'll be $3.50, through my teeth, because by this time I'm like, you know, just trying to maintain. He said, well, you know what? That's a $2.70 fare, meaning I had taken him out of his way. He said, I'm not going to leave you a tip. Well, it was the straw that broke the camel's back. And I start screaming wildly at the top of my lungs, so much so that I created a crowd around me out of this cab. And all these little people started to come out. This little Chinese girl said, call the police. No, just get this man out of my cab. I don't want to see him. Screaming. And I'm, you know, like, and the guy says, settle down in the back seat. And I'm like, and he gives me the $3.50. And then he gives me a dollar tip. And as he gives me the dollar tip, he says, I gotcha, didn't I?
With the help of two psychic readings, one mugging, and one witnessing of a murder, he decided it was time to leave New York for sunny California.
It was great. I mean, I really liked it right from the start almost. You know, it was a little adjustment because it's very different from New York. It's a different world. In New York, you know, everyone's sort of hostile. Here, everyone's your best friend within the first 2 hours. You know, and everyone just thinks you're fabulous. And there's all this hidden agenda going on. But when you're first here, you don't quite get it, you know. No one's rude to anyone because they don't know where you're going to be tomorrow. And they may need you tomorrow. And you don't get that early on. You know, you just think, well, everyone's being so...
And this could be a story about the hypocrisy and sleaziness of L.A. But it's not.
I think I'm more at peace here. And I really discovered Buddhism here. I mean, up until that time, I was, you know, this sort of a sort of errant, you know, Lutheran boy. And I had, you know, I was a victim. Let's just say it. I was a victim. I really played that. You know, I had sort of a screwed up childhood. And I really felt victimized by it. And I spent a lot of time being a victim, you know, and letting people feel sorry for myself. And I went to my first Buddhist meeting. And I told him my sad story about how my mother deserted me when I was 4 months and ran off with another man and how my life was really awful. And they were like, so? And I was like, no, you don't understand. Let me tell my story again, because I usually get a different reaction. I was deserted by my mother when I was 4 months. You know, and I was like playing it for all it was worth. And they were like, well, what are you going to do about that? And it was the very first time that someone told me, well, take responsibility for your life. You know, you create that. You can create unhappiness. You can create happiness. And that was a major, major change. Well, I had this friend who was relentless, just hateful. And she was like, you got to come to this meeting. You really have to. And I was like, go away. I'm not interested. This is not anything I'm interested in. It's a cult. Get out of my life. And she just wouldn't give up. And so finally, she insisted I go to one of these meetings. And at this point, I was worn down. I said, all right, I'll go to one of these stupid meetings. And so it was sort of drag, kicking and screaming. And they were all so very happy. And I thought, you know, what have they got to be happy about? You know, and I thought it seemed genuine. And I do remember going up the walkway and hearing the sound of the chanting. And I went, I felt like I was home. There was something about it. I can't put my finger on it. But then I went to the meeting and I was my usual negative self. And I was just like, you know. And she said, well, now you have to chant. I said, absolutely not. Absolutely not. I'm not interested. Well, eventually I started chanting. I said, all right, I'll chant. And I'll show you how it doesn't work. So I started chanting. And in spite of all that kind of attitude, things started changing. When I started chanting, it was the beginning of the AIDS epidemic. And I think I had one of the very first Buddhists as a member. You know, you have people that you help who was dying of AIDS. Ultimately, I had now about 49 people who have died of AIDS who were friends of mine. And there were times where, you know, I was going to hospitals 3 and 4 nights a week, you know, dealing with people in various stages of decay or dying. And it hadn't been for Buddhism, I never could have gotten through that, you know, of really. And I had one in particular person who was my member, who I had introduced to the practice, and just a really great guy. And I sort of, immediately connected when I saw him. And so he was in Cedar Sinai, and it was his last week. And everyone knew he was going to die soon. And I hadn't seen him in 3 days because the family had come in from all over the country, and I thought, I need to give them the space to be with him in these last moments. And then I thought, you know, should I go this last day or not? You know, I thought, you know what? I'm just going to show up for a little bit. I'll go in, you know, maybe chant with him, you know, chant while at this point, he'd been in a coma for 4 days. So the family, unfortunately, never got to see him awake, you know. Oh, they hated the fact that he chanted. Oh, they didn't want him to chant. Really Catholic, you know. And when I actually came into the room, you know, the priest was going out the door as I was coming in, and they had just given him the final rites. And I walked into the room, there was like about 10 people in the room, all sort of chairs around. And it was so dark. The energy was so dark. Yeah, he was gay as well. Well, they weren't wild about that either. I mean, you know, and to surround him with that kind of energy, you know, at the end. And I was like, it was like walking into the darkest room. And I just said, you know, we chant morning and evening. And already the eyes were being raised and they were getting very judgmental. And I said, I'd really like to do the evening prayers with him. You know, I hope you don't mind. But if it's okay, I'd really like to do that. So the sister was sort of like, well, okay, you know. And I said, there is this part in the chanting where you can all join in should you want. And it's when we get to Nam-myoho-renge-kyo, you know. And you could tell that this was as foreign to them as they were ever going to get. There was no way. Now, Joseph had always wanted, this guy's name was Joseph, had always wanted his family to chant. That was his dream, that they would someday chant with him. It was far-fetched, you know, but it was his dream, especially when they were so rigidly Catholic. So I started the prayers, and it's, you know, it starts Myoho Rengigo, Hoban Bandani, Niji Seizan Josamai, Anjo Niki Goshiyatsu Shobuje, Jinjimuryo Gochiemang. It's not easy, you know, and it goes very rapidly. And I was trying to do it very rapidly because I wanted to get through it without not alienating them. Well, within the first 2 minutes, his eyes opened. And his eyes sort of rolled up, and he started focusing on me. And I just kept on chanting, and I was like nodding my head. And pretty soon his lips started moving, you know. And I was like, oh my God. And now you could hear the gasps in the room. People started gasping, you know. And it got to the point where he started chanting with me. And now he's fully back. He's fully awake. And he's looking right at me. And we're chanting together, you know. And you could hear people just sort of like in the rooms. And you could just hear the whole energy change. You know, everybody was just. And we got to the point where it was Nam-myoho Renge-kyo, where they all could join in. And the entire room started chanting. The whole family. It was just like vibrant. And Joseph never took his eyes off of me. I've never experienced anything so intimate. When someone's looking at you for the very last time, they're the last person you're going to see. So I started chanting with him, and the whole room started chanting, and I reached onto his ear, and I said, Joseph, do you hear that? Your entire family is chanting with you. And this tear rolled down his cheek, and he raised his hand, and he waved goodbye. And then he died. And people... Oh, it was an amazing thing. It was just amazing. And we chanted for like a half hour after that. You know, and I held his hand. You know, people when they die, they have like a tremor. There's like an energy that happens. And it tremors for a while. And I held his hand until the tremoring stopped. And we chanted for like a half hour. And then I eventually said, we have to stop because we have to establish time of death. So we have to tell the nurse that he died. And the thing that was great about it was that when he looked at me after being those 4 days in a coma, there wasn't an ounce of fear. It wasn't like he was bewildered. It wasn't like he was scared. It wasn't like, you know, he got it. And people floated out of that room. And the sister, who was very so judgmental at the beginning, came up to me and she said, I never thought it could be that beautiful. I never thought that act of passing could be such a beautiful thing. And it really was. I mean, this AIDS epidemic, people that dealt with AIDS, who hung in there with people, ended up changed because you had to, you know, you had to come up with some kind of compassion in a whole different way, whole different level. I had a friend who died. I love this story, who died in Seattle. Similar situation. The guy had been in a coma a long time and he was really afraid of dying. And Maggie came in and sat by his bed. And suddenly he woke up out of this coma and he looked at her and he said, Maggie, there's a guy here with a big white horse. What do you think I should do? And Maggie looked at him and she said, John, I think you should get on that horse. So there was this long pause and then he said, hi ho silver and away, and then died. His last line was hi ho silver and away. Which I thought was great. I thought if you're gonna go, go on a white horse. I had this dream once where I was in 10th century Korea, go figure, and I and another soldier were being beheaded. And my friend's head was on the block and my head was on another block, the two of us, you know. And this guy came down and he raised this sort of big machete-like thing, you know. And my friend's head was cut off. And I thought, you know, this is not going to be a close call. You're out of here. You know, this is like... And then this wave of panic came over me. Just a wave. And I was like scared. And, you know, because it was imminent. And suddenly, I swooped down on my body. And I'm sitting there above it, looking at my body below. And I see this knife being raised. And I see my head fall. And I am alive. I am, this wave of joy came over me that I cannot even begin to tell you. And I remember thinking in the dream, this is what everybody's scared of? This is what everybody's frightened of? Holy God, this is fabulous. You know, it was so light, and it was like kind of a universal love that I've never even begun to experience in this plane. You know, and after that dream, I thought, oh, what's to be frightened of?
So I asked, were the New York things about you? Things you attracted to yourself?
Oh yeah, I really believe that was a reflection of where I was at that time. I mean, the things he said, you know, faggot, flop, you know, certainly that was stuff that I think I was feeling, you know, he just expressed it. And the thing that really changed, and God, if there's anything I wish I could pass on would be this, is that my life really changed when I started appreciating my life, appreciating what happened to me every day, as opposed to thinking in bed at night, oh, this person did this to me and this person, you know. I mean, it really turned around when I started making a little list of things. You know, the person at the Ralph's opened the door for me today. Wasn't that nice of them to do that? You know, I got to see these wonderful flowers today. Wasn't that a great experience? You know, and I started itemizing that stuff, and better things started happening. It's like, you know, if you're in a state, and Buddhism talks about this, if you're in a state of need, well, what you're putting out ultimately is need. And the environment gives you more to need. Wherein, once you start appreciating what you have, the environment gives you more to appreciate. Oh, you really like that? Well, here, try this on. This, you can really appreciate this. And now I have a really amazing life, more than I ever imagined. You know, wonderful friends, just wonderful friends.
In Los Angeles, we were talking with Fred Ponsloff.
This is Hitchhiking Off the Map. We want to talk about some things that are coming up. And we should mention, too, that somebody asked us, well, do you ever take stories from just somebody listening and saying, I have a story?
Yes.
Yes. We do these long features, but it doesn't have to be that. We would like very much to have some more short pieces, too. What about the craziest thing that ever happened to you on a trip, or your first date?
Or the first day at school, or your graduation, or the first time you got drunk.
Or house hunting, moving, walking down the aisle, climbing the mountain. You can write us at info@independenteye.org or through our website, www.independenteye.org. I is EYE, and it's all one word.
And in the coming weeks, two storytellers contributing to the rebuilding of Kosovo.
And I just walked about 5 miles up the 101 talking with a man who has completed 3,000 miles of a 10,000-mile hike around the periphery of the United States.
And a woman's beautiful journal about her husband's process of dying.
A genuine, card-carrying, literal hitchhiker. After an entire year, I finally actually interviewed somebody about being a hitchhiker. We're working on several projects that will go into specials and CDs. Peacemakers, war veterans, octogenarians. Give us leads to any of those, and we'll be very grateful. And here are a few thoughts about journeys. Whenever I prepare for a journey, I prepare as though for death.
The great and recurrent question about a trip abroad is it worth getting there?
What gives value to travel is fear. There is no pleasure in traveling, and I look upon it more as an occasion for spiritual testing.
These are quotes, folks, quotes.
But on the other hand,
it is good to have an end to journey toward, but it is the journey that matters in the end.
Heroes take journeys, confront dragons, and discover the treasure of their true selves.
We do not receive wisdom. We must discover it for ourselves. After a journey through the wilderness, which no one else can make for us, which no one can spare us, for our wisdom is the point of view from which we come at last to regard the world.
These thoughts from Catherine Mansfield, Albert Camus, Rose Macaulay, Ursula Le Guin, Carol Pearson, and Marcel Proust. For further advice, consult your local travel agent.
Hitchhiking Off the Map is produced by The Independent Eye with funding from the National Endowment for the Arts and the California Arts Council.
And from the Hitchhikers Guild, which you can join by visiting our website again, www.independenteye.org.
And you'll find our CDs there, Nativity, The Descent of Inanna, Family Snapshots, and others.
Next up, controversial singer and Earth First activist Daryl Cherney talks about the long trip that brought him into a car that exploded. I wonder why I said controversial. Why are some people labeled controversial? When I was in first grade, there was a little boy named Donald, and he really stank. Now, that's controversial. But what do I know about politics? This is Conrad Bishop.
And Elizabeth Fuller. Peace and joy.
Then I had another friend that had an experience where this guy, again, was very afraid of dying. You know, had been in a coma a long time. Anyway, this guy was very afraid of dying, and my friend went in. And then the day before he died, he was sitting up in his bed, like totally happy, totally, you know, at peace, everything, you know. And she said, "Harry, what happened?" He said, "I got my next assignment. I got my next assignment. I'm working with a tribe in Africa. I'm going to be their spiritual advisor. They're fabulous. I was there last night. It's terrific." And he died that night. He had a job interview. He did the job interview, thought it was great, and moved on, you know? So, I mean, that's, you know, that really is. And that's why I'm not really afraid of dying, because I see where it goes.